Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, we're going to talk about the Queen. Our article, which has been edited for length, is from the BBC and is entitled, Queen Elizabeth II Has Died. Queen Elizabeth II, the UK's longest-serving monarch, has died at Balmoral, aged 96, after reigning for 70 years. She died peacefully on Thursday afternoon at her Scottish estate, where she had spent much of the summer. The Queen came to the throne in 1952 and witnessed enormous social change. Her son, King Charles III, said the death of his beloved mother was a moment of great sadness for him and his family, and that her loss would be deeply felt around the world. He said, "We mourn profoundly the passing of a cherished sovereign and a much-loved mother. I know her loss will be deeply felt throughout the country, the realms, and the Commonwealth, and by countless people around the world." During the coming period of mourning, he said he and his family would be comforted and sustained by our knowledge of the respect and deep affection in which the Queen was so widely held. Prime Minister Liz Truss, who was appointed by the Queen on Tuesday, said the monarch was the rock on which modern Britain was built, who had provided us with the stability and strength that we needed. Speaking about the new king, she said, "We offer him our loyalty and devotion, just as his mother devoted so much to so many for so long." And with the passing of the second Elizabethan age, we usher in a new era in the magnificent history of our great country, exactly as Her Majesty would have wished by saying the words, "God save the King." The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, spiritual leader to the Church of England, of which the monarch is the supreme governor, expressed his profound sadness. He said his prayers are with the King and the royal family. Queen Elizabeth II's tenure as head of state spanned post-war austerity, the transition from empire to Commonwealth, the end of the Cold War, and the UK's entry into and withdrawal from the European Union. Her reign spanned 15 prime ministers, starting with Winston Churchill, born 1874, and including Miss Truss, born 101 years later in 1975. She held weekly audiences with her prime ministers throughout her reign. At Buckingham Palace in London, crowds awaiting updates on the Queen's condition began crying as they heard of her death. The Queen was born Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor in Mayfair, London, on 21 April 1926. Few could have foreseen that she would become monarch, but in December 1936, her uncle Edward VIII abdicated from the throne to marry the twice-divorced American Wallis Simpson. Elizabeth's father became King George VI, and at age 10, Lilibet, as she was known in the family, became heir to the throne. Within 3 years, Britain was at war with Nazi Germany. Elizabeth and her younger sister, Princess Margaret, spent much of the wartime at Windsor Castle after their parents rejected suggestions they be evacuated to Canada. After turning 18, Elizabeth spent 5 months with the Auxiliary Territorial Service and learned basic motor mechanic and driving skills. "I began to understand the esprit de corps that flourished in the face of adversity," she recalled later. Through the war, she exchanged letters with her third cousin, Philip, Prince of Greece, who was serving in the Royal Navy. Their romance blossomed, and the couple married at Westminster Abbey on 20 November 1947, with the prince taking the title Duke of Edinburgh. She would later describe him as "my strength and stay" through 74 years of marriage before his death in 2021, aged 99. Their first son, Charles, was born in 1948, followed by Princess Anne in 1950, Prince Andrew in 1960, and Prince Edward in 1964. Between them, they gave their parents 8 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. Princess Elizabeth was in Kenya in 1952, representing the ailing king, when Philip broke the news that her father had died. She immediately returned to London as the new queen. "It was all a very sudden kind of taking on and making the best job you can," she later recalled. Elizabeth was crowned at Westminster Abbey on 2 June 1953, aged 27, in front of a then-record TV audience estimated at more than 20 million people. Subsequent decades would see great change, with the end of the British Empire overseas and the swinging 60s sweeping away social norms at home. Elizabeth reformed the monarchy for this less deferential age, engaging with the public through walkabouts, royal visits, and attendance at public events. Her commitment to the Commonwealth was a constant. She visited every Commonwealth country at least once. As a 21-year-old princess, Elizabeth had vowed to devote her life to service. Reflecting on those words decades later, during her Silver Jubilee in 1977, she declared, "Although that vow was made in my salad days, when I was green in judgment, I do not regret nor retract one word of it. That same commitment to serving was made 45 years later in a thank you letter to the nation on the weekend of her Platinum Jubilee in June. You know, what stands out to me, and has always stood out to me as being of vital importance when discussing the Queen, is that she viewed her position, and others, generally speaking, viewed her position as one of service. Indeed, it is not just the contemporary British monarchy, but in talk about monarchies around the world and in the past, there was much talk of service. Often the word used was duty. There is a sense that there's a trade-off. Yes, when you're the monarch, you get lots of money and nice stuff, and you get big houses, and people have to kneel and all that jazz. But the trade-off is that your life is a life of never-ending duty and service. You are choosing to live in a fishbowl. And in times past, it was a very carnivorous fishbowl. History and literature have no lack of stories about soon-to-be monarchs who run away. Now, perhaps that doesn't quite hit us with our democratic and modernist sensibilities. Why would anyone run away when they have the opportunity to wield authority? Why would people run away from a life of wealth, power, and prestige? Maybe because it's not all it's cracked up to be. Maybe the trade-offs that must be made to live a life of monarchical wealth, prestige, and power are more than most can bear. Now look, I'm not going to try to convince you that monarchy is all about service, because frankly, we're all Americans, and we hold a pretty low view of monarchy around these parts. And I'm sure that even my talking about monarchy as service and duty has some of your Uncle Sam senses tingling. Maybe you're thinking, well, golly, Luke, all this pro-monarchy talk makes me wonder if you're a secret monarchist. And so I understand that some of you are thinking that maybe, just maybe, I'm a crypto-imperialist. Yes, and maybe, just maybe, I really want to overthrow the government and reassert Charles III as our rightful and lawful sovereign. Maybe all this radio preaching over all these years has just been one long ruse, so that someday, eventually, upon the death of the Queen, I could rally my half dozen listeners and we could begin a movement to revoke the Constitution and have the people of this colony sing, "God save the King from sea to shining sea." Maybe that's what this is. Maybe that's what I'm doing, but I guess you'll never know. Or conversely, you can know that that's not at all what I'm doing. I am not trying to reestablish a monarchy. But what I can say and what I will say is that I do, in fact, believe that monarchs at their best are servants to their people. Monarchs at their best represent stability, the honor of traditions and norms. They are a voice for the past that can guide the future. At their best, monarchs can guide a people, a nation, an empire, and they can guide them into greater prosperity, greater morality, greater unity. A monarch can unite a people by reminding them that there is something that binds them and that goes beyond ideology or even blood and soil. A devotion to a monarch is able to unite people of broad differences, ideological, religious, racial, economic, and so on. And this is both good and bad. It's good when it allows modern Britons, some Anglo, some Scottish, some Welsh, some Irish, some Jewish, some Indian, some Pakistani, some African, some Arab, some Caribbean, and even some French, to all unite around a person whom they call a sovereign. Now, right now you're thinking, there he goes with this pro-monarchy crap again. Luke, don't you know that what you're saying is heretical? It's idolatry! No. No, it isn't idolatry. It's close to it, sure. Sure, respecting a sovereign king or queen is always going to be in danger of becoming idolatrous, but don't let's pretend that there isn't an equal and opposite error. Treating royals as if they were nobodies because you don't want to be an idolater is crass and rude and violates Romans 13 and is in danger of becoming blasphemous. Idolatry and blasphemy are two sides of the same coin, which is the corruption of the image of God. When we mistake the glory inherent in man as a glory to replace God's, it is idolatry. When we denigrate the glory inherent as not glory worth glorying in, we blaspheme the image. That's why, despite how many problems I have with the Roman Catholic Church, I've never bashed them for their ornate vestments and clerical garb. I've never had a problem with priests wearing special clothes that separate them from other people and give them special honor and dignity. And it isn't just Catholics who have clerical vestments, by the way. And the reason that I, as an ex-Catholic Mennonite, have no problem with and even encourage clerical vestments is not because I think priests and pastors are just better and holier than lay Christians. I mean, sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. But that's not what it's all about. Vestments are about dignity and honor to the office, and the hope is that the man in the garb will strive to live up to the honor imbued into his collar or robe or stole or mitre. The point is not that you look at the guy in the long robes with the funny hat and say, "Wow, he must be very pious." The point is that you look at him and say, "Wow, he stands in an office that is honorable, and he is the personal embodiment of an ideology that honors God and his servants." Now, you might think that I'm cutting that hair into some pretty fine splits. Okay, maybe. And maybe I'm just a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, but I think that there is nothing inherently idolatrous about looking to the Queen and pledging loyalty to her, or King Charles. Can it be idolatrous? Of course. Is it by necessity? Of course not. And can it lead us to deeper anthropological truth? Most definitely. God has made us to want to seek to elevate someone or something. We are made to worship. We have an innate and unshakable impulse to look to someone and pledge loyalty and fealty to them. We are, if you'll forgive the neologism, we are obligate worshipers. We die if we don't worship, and so we find things to worship. And part of being obligate worshipers is that we want to elevate those we worship to kingship and queenship and lordship. We want those whom we worship to lead us and command us. There is something inherently submissive in humanity. Part of our inherent need to worship is a need to serve, to dedicate our lives to not merely a cause, but a person. Now, when that person is God, the worship and service are glorious and redound to our own personal flourishing. When we direct worship, not merely loyalty, but worship towards someone who isn't God, that worship becomes idolatry, and the service becomes servile. There is a distinction with a difference between being a servant and being servile. Just as there is a difference between being loyal to your queen and dedicating your life in service to her as a way of serving God, there's a difference between that and worshiping the queen and licking her boots. And let me, in fact, go farther. There is a sense in which we should worship people who aren't God. The old English word worship really means to pay honor to worth. It was worth-ship. So when you see something worthy, you give it its due. If a man was worthy of praise, you praised him. If a woman was worthy of honor, you honored her. You gave her worth-ship. I know that's not how we use the word in contemporary theology today. I'm aware that that's not how we use the word. But what I'm suggesting is not that words change, but that perhaps we've lost a concept. Perhaps in our move to modernity and postmodernity, we've lost this nuanced middle ground of paying honor to worth in a way that is worship, but not idolatry. Because in the end, we are, all of us, bearers of the image of God. And if God is glorious and worthy of worship, then aren't those who bear his image also glorious and worthy of worship? Yes, God deserves greater honor and our first loyalty. He deserves our best love, but does that mean that others are entitled to no honor and no loyalty and no love? Just because God is entitled to our highest and first worship, does that mean that no one else is entitled to any? Let me go yet further. I'm sure you've already started to doubt my orthodoxy at this point, but hey, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. So let me go yet further and say that the worship that a husband pays a wife, the worship that a daughter pays her father, the worship a knight pays to his queen, the worship that a queen pays to the nation, perhaps these are not idolatries, but rather are inklings, just little hints, just appetizers that train our emotions, our intellects, our heads, and our hearts to worship Christ as the greatest and most glorious. Perhaps if we wander about in the old attic of truth, rummaging through the lost and past ideologies and theologies of human history, maybe as we wander through these Matham houses, we would discover that the love and honor and devotion we pay one another are not the fusty, tattered cobwebs of a dead and dying paganism that get in our eyes and stick to us, leaving us like we need a bath. Perhaps they're the old tin soldiers, imitations, and yes, sometimes bad imitations, but of truly courageous men from a bygone time. Imitations, yes, but imitations that point to a greater reality. And like the tin soldiers, they once filled us with happiness and imagination and gave us grand notions of duty, honor, sacrifice, loyalty, bravery, brotherhood, and more. Now that we're older and wiser, we know that they're imitations, just a game, and yet part of us knows that they were real and that they served a purpose. Someday, all the vestments and royalties and honors will be swept away and a new economy of honor will be established, and we'll see, once for all, what kings and kingdoms pointed to. We'll see what all the funny hats and strange uniforms were all about. We'll see Christ, and when we see Christ, it will all make sense. Even what was wrong will make sense now that we know the right. The king is coming. And someday we will see him, and everything will make sense. Let us live in light of that truth. I hope and pray we will, and I hope you'll join us again next time for another exciting episode of Truth in Journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day to his glory.